Welcome to Parenting a Distractible, Inattentive, or Hyperactive Child. My name is Sarah Dimmerman, also known as Help Me Sarah, and I'm joined today by Carol Barber and Kate Davidson. Carol is a member of the College of Psychologists of Ontario and has many years of experience in consultation and assessment roles with preschool and school-age children within hospital and public school settings. Kate is also a member of the College of Psychologists of Ontario, is currently working in the public school system, and also has a private practice in the Greater Toronto Area. Over the next little while, we're going to chat about the ins and outs of parenting a distractible, inattentive, or hyperactive child. I know that this is a topic that many parents can relate to. I often receive calls from parents who are getting complaints from teachers or at a loss themselves for what strategies to try at home in regards to behaviors such as their child not following requests, being distracted away from the task at hand, or not being able to sit still. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Maybe we could begin with each of you or one of you or both giving me examples of the kinds of situations that either one or both of you may be called in to handle. So we're going to begin with you, Carol.
Okay. Usually what parents tell us, and teachers also, is that children that they're working with or they have at home are very inattentive. So they're finding that they're making a lot of careless errors, they're not finishing their work, whatever it is, schoolwork or a task at home, they're flittering from one activity to another, and they tend to be rather impulsive. So they're blurting out an answer without thinking, they're interrupting people, they might be dashing through the yard and onto the street without thinking, and they tend to be rather active, jumping up and down in their seat, in and out of their seat, not sitting still, in and out of bed. All of those things are typically, I mean, teachers wouldn't obviously be thinking about getting how they are at home, but that's what parents are often reporting.
So now, what age group are we talking about here? Because, you know, if you have a two-year-old that's running around like a crazy person, I mean, would you automatically assume that that two-year-old is hyperactive or inattentive?
That's an excellent question, Sarah, because what we know about ADHD is that it can be tricky to diagnose. There are a lot of factors, and there isn't a blood test or there isn't an x-ray to say yes, a child has it or no, a child doesn't. And we also know that activity is pretty normal in children. They often tend to be active and they're running around. They often are impulsive when they're tired or they're excited or they're hungry. And they can be very inattentive too. So those things are normal. And we know that developmentally, preschoolers, two-year-olds, three-year-olds, four-year-olds, tend to be more active and more impulsive and more inattentive than older children. So attention and impulsivity and hyperactivity change developmentally
When you talked about the ADHD, just to clarify, so ADHD stands for Attention Deficit
Hyperactivity Disorder.
And it could also be ADD, so you've got the Attention Deficit Disorder without the hyperactivity,
That's
right?
That's correct.
But what I'm hearing you say is that it's difficult to gauge maybe at any age, but especially difficult with that preschool age group because they tend to be that way anyway.
And a lot of parents don't have a norm of reference. They might have an only child and that child may not be, they might not be observing that child with a lot of other children. Teachers have that ability to do that, so it's hard to know. So when you're asking me, well, then when does it become a perhaps ADHD, so to speak. And that's when the behavior becomes a problem. You're seeing those behaviors all day long in different situations. There's a history of that. So it wasn't just this week. It wasn't the week of Christmas.
Right.
Or March break holiday, or when we're at a resort in the Caribbean, but it's all the time in different situations, at school, at home, out in the community.
And I like what you said about being able to look at your child comparing his or her behavior with that of his or her peers. So we know that there are normal ranges of development socially, emotionally, physically, and I know that that can range like within 6 months either way, but there are norms that people look at, especially when we're doing assessments, correct?
That's correct.
So I think that you're right. I would imagine maybe Kate, you can talk to this about perhaps when these kinds of symptoms are become most problematic is when children start to go into more of a regimented or a disciplined type of environment. So even like junior or senior kindergarten, or especially into grade one, where kids are having to sit still for longer periods of time and having to follow instructions. Because often parents might say to me with a young child, well, we don't have any problems at home. And then I might explore with them, well, what are your expectations at home? You know, really, how long do you expect your child to sit still for? And it may only be like 10 minutes while they're eating dinner. But then they go to school and they're expected to sit still for maybe a half an hour or 45 minutes. And the teacher is noticing that that child is wriggling around or is disrupting the classroom or is jabbing his or her friends. So can you talk to that, Kate?
We absolutely see that that difference in when you put a lot more structure in place. So I think that you actually answered a lot of your own question in describing how children at home are often able to move quickly from one activity to another. Maybe they're watching television and able to pay attention to that for a long period of time. But then when we get to school, it becomes very difficult to follow the structure and the rules and guidelines set out by somebody else and to keep attention focused on that and to stop oneself from moving around.
So often it's the teacher that might bring this to parents' attention in the first time. Did you want to respond to that, Carol?
Also, in situations that are a little more challenging for children, maybe a little more boring, they're not as exciting, not as reinforcing, then you'll see some of those symptoms, the inattention, the impulsivity, heighten more than in situations that are more fun.
So what are some of the symptoms? I mean, we talk about it more globally in terms of like impulsivity or hyperactivity or distractibility. But can you be, you know, talking about the younger age group maybe, can either of you think of specific things? I know you've mentioned some of them, but a child that's impulsive might act how compared to children who are not as impulsive? Kate, do you want to talk to that?
Yeah, well, certainly when you have a younger child, so I'm thinking of a child in kindergarten, so about 4 or 5 years old, what we often see is in the beginning of coming into school is difficulty staying with the group. So when the teacher is running a circle program or having some kind of assigned task, it's very difficult for some children to stay with the teacher and follow along. I've just lost my train of thought, sorry.
Carol has something to say in the meantime.
They blurt out their answers. They're not waiting to put up their hand or waiting for the other student to finish talking. They blurt out. They interrupt. They move from activity to activity. They're looking around all the time, not looking at the teacher.
And is it true that a child can be inattentive without being as hyper? We talked about that they don't have to be hyperactive.
Absolutely.
Or they may not be as impulsive. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
And those children maybe missed more than the child that's hyperactive, because the child that's hyperactive at home or at school, then parents and teachers are constantly noticing, right. Oh, he's not where he's supposed to be. Oh, right. She needs to come back here, come and sit down. Whereas a child that's just sitting and daydreaming, looking at the walls, looking at what someone else is doing, isn't a problem, so to speak.
Looking at the walls or daydreaming would be more of an inattentive type of behavior.
That's right.
Kate, did you want to say something more?
Yeah, I do. With the diagnosis of ADHD, we often talk about ADD, but in terms of the diagnostic manual, we see it's called ADHD inattentive type or ADHD hyperactive impulsive type or the combined type. So sometimes there may also be a diagnosis of ADHD, even though the child is primarily inattentive or daydreamy, not able to follow along. These children, often we don't see a lot of behavior problems in the more inattentive child, because they will sit quietly in their seat, but not necessarily produce a lot of work. So you may not notice the inattentive type as much in kindergarten or in the younger years. It becomes more around grade one, grade two, when the child is required to sit at a desk and independently produce some schoolwork.
So did you want to add to that, Carol?
And developmentally, you may see that activity, that hyperactivity component in a group of children that have ADHD, but as they grow older and they mature into their teenage years, they lose that activity part as well. So you do see primarily more inattentive difficulties, and the same with adults.
So I know that, you know, some people say that ADD is an overdiagnosed disorder. And, you know, so I talk about it as like true ADD, what's really true ADD, versus what looks like ADD, but maybe something else. And I know that sometimes, you know, often with a child who has ADD, they often have other things going on that we call comorbid factors, would it be? Or comorbid whatever. Can you talk about that, Kate?
Well, I think the first part is you've brought up the idea of having true ADHD or having something else as well. And then there's the part of having ADHD with another disorder. So one of the things we first want to look at is having a really thorough assessment of why the attention problems or overactivity is occurring. And this often involves a couple of professionals. So usually consultation with a pediatrician or family doctor, as well as with school personnel, perhaps the school psychology staff or a private practice psychology consultant. And what we want to do is make sure that the inattention or hyperactivity is not due to a factor other than just inattention and ADHD. Other things that might affect kids are things like sleep. So a child who is not necessarily sleeping well, so maybe falling asleep and staying in bed the whole night, but they may not be going into the depth of sleep that we need. They may be circulating through stage 1, 2, and 3 sleep, waking up and never getting into that deep sleep. Those children will be inattentive and overactive because of sleep problems rather than ADHD. So we want to rule that out first. We also want to look at general medical factors, things like diet and food sensitivities, making sure that the child is able to absorb all the nutrients they need. And one of the things that might interfere with that is something like celiac disease or another kind of allergy that moves food quickly through the body. And with treatment of the primary disorder, sometimes we see the attention go away. So if you treat a sleep disorder or you treat celiac disease, then over time the attention will start to improve. But if we don't have any of those other factors, then we're often looking at ADHD.
So in that way, if the parent or the school personnel were not to look at those other concerns or other possibilities, then a child may be incorrectly diagnosed as having ADD. Whereas, as you said, if other things are diagnosed and worked on, then in fact the symptoms that the parent or the school is seeing may go away.
Yes.
So what I'm hearing is it's really important to have a comprehensive assessment. It's not just about a psychologist or somebody within the school doing an assessment or but to speak to the pediatrician to get a team approach to looking at this.
Absolutely, and that goes for assessment, but also for treatment and follow-up, to have a couple of people looking at that from different perspectives.
So you know, how do children get? Let's say that you've ruled out those other factors. The child is sleeping well, not sensitive to foods. Why do children have ADD or ADHD? How do they get it, so to speak?
There's a number of different ways. So certainly we know that there are genetic components to ADHD. What the research is showing is that it's actually an interaction between genetics and environment. So you can have the genes for ADHD, but live within a very structured, supportive environment that doesn't necessarily mean you'll display symptoms. But with an environment that's not a good fit with the genes, then it may manifest as ADHD.
Okay. So I know a lot of parents blame themselves, but really how are parents to blame for what they inherit themselves, right? So we know, I know that many parents, Carol, do you know the stats on that in terms of the number of parents that have children with ADD in terms of the percentage?
No, I'm not. The amount of children with diagnosable ADHD would be 5% in the population, so about 1 in 20. I'm not sure the inheritability.
Okay. But I've heard that there's quite, I think it's maybe 50% or more.
I think it's, between 50 and 80% heritable, from what I've read.
Right, so that's quite high in terms of, So more often than not, there's going to be at least one parent that has some form of ADD, but may have really found ways to work through it. Maybe when they were younger, they weren't diagnosed, but they found organizational ways to to compensate for it. Yeah. And so I know that often parents will come to me, and I don't assess or treat for ADD, but I'll refer out. But sometimes I'll have a red flag that this may be going on, and the parent will say, but there's no, you know, I was like that when I was 4 years old, and it's just a phase he's going to grow out of, and look at me now.
And what we know about ADHD is that some people do grow out of it. So, and some people just learn to cope with it. Like you said, they find those organizational strategies and those tools that help them to compensate for the attentional difficulties that they have.
And I know that there's an amazing website for adults with ADD called totallyadd.com. And that's specifically, you know, for adults to even go online and take a little mini test to see whether, in fact, they're, you know, displaying the symptoms of ADD or ADHD. And then it's a fun website, but it's a very educational website. Mm-hmm. And I know somebody too who's an adult who has an ADD coach. So she talks to her coach once a week, who guides her through strategies to learn how to become less distractible, more focused, that kind of thing. So there are lots of behavioral things that parents can do to help.
Mm-hmm. Carol? I just want to bring up a couple of points that you touched on, Zara. When you talked about adults with ADHD, go back to that point that I made where when adults have a primary attention problem, you're seeing mainly the inattentive type. So it's not as apparent as it is for children that might have the inattentive and the hyperactivity component when they're younger.
Right.
So, you know, it still can exist, as Kate said, but it looks different.
Right, the hyperactive one, they may be more impulsive or inattentive, as you said, but not as hyperactive.
And the other thing, too, is when we're just talking about the genetic components of ADHD, and I believe it's not one gene, but a group of genes, a lot of parents will think, well, it's genetic, so there's nothing you can do about that. You can't fix that. But you were using language like treated, Kate was too, and improved, and parent support groups. So there actually are a lot of things that can be done to make those symptoms better.
Right.
And to manage the behavior and make improvements. So I think that's a really important point.
I like that too, because I think it's important, as you said, just to even reinforce that, because I want parents to know that this is very treatable and very workable. Just to go back a little bit, Kate, to what you said about the genetics, and then I know there's some research also in terms of ADD being like a neurological, having a neurological brace. Can you talk a little bit about how the brain works in this way?
Okay, I actually like to use the analogy of a conductor and an orchestra. So the orchestra being the brain, we assume that a child with true ADHD, if we're assuming that there aren't a lot of other complicating factors like learning disabilities and other things that may be affecting the child, has generally average intelligence. So they've got all the instruments in the orchestra. The instruments work well, but there's not always a conductor in the front telling them which instrument to use when. So that's when we see a child with ADHD maybe not able to sit still in the group on the carpet during a story time with the teacher. But when the teacher steps in and says, you know, you need to sit down, cross your legs, and put your hands on your knees, the child's able to do all of those things, but they don't have their own conductor telling them what to do. And that conductor in the brain is actually right behind the forehead. It's called the prefrontal cortex, and this is where we're able to organize, plan, think ahead for things, even shifting from one task to another. Sometimes we see children with ADHD getting stuck on something and they have a hard time transitioning to the next activity or maintaining emotional control. That's all happening right in your forehead, behind your eyebrows. And what we know about ADHD from the research is that the brain structures are all there, but the chemicals move a little more slowly through that prefrontal cortex.
And that's that's why medication is often recommended as a way of helping bridge that gap, correct?
Yes.
So I know that none of us are in the position where we can prescribe medication, so that would be up to the pediatrician or the neuropsychiatrist. But can you talk a little bit about it? Because there's stimulant medications, which you'd think would actually make the child more hyperactive or excitable, right? But
yes,
in ADD, it has what we call a paradoxical effect. It has the reverse effect.
And it's because that conductor is underactive that when we stimulate the neurochemicals in the prefrontal cortex, that the conductor kind of stands up and is ready to organize the brain. It does seem strange that it's a stimulant that would calm a child down, but we know that in children with ADHD, they need that stimulation to be able to.
And what I've been told, I don't know if you've seen this too, is that children who don't have true ADD do not respond the same way to stimulant medication.
And to a degree, that's true. There are children who certainly will respond by becoming more excitable or more anxious even. But there are also children who will respond to medications who don't have ADHD. So for example, the child with a sleep disorder will respond very well to a stimulant medication to wake up the brain a little bit, but it's not necessarily because it was ADHD that the medication is acting on. One very important thing is that we say response to medication doesn't necessarily mean a diagnosis. And there are some children who have ADHD who don't respond as well. There's some research coming out suggesting that there are genetic factors, again, in how we respond to medications, and that some of us are better able to respond to these medications than others.
So, and I know that you touched on this, Kate, in terms of, sometimes there are other things going on, and I don't think we talked a lot about the comorbid. Carol, did you want to talk about what else may be going on? You know, we talked about some of it, but I know that often there might be a learning disability, correct?
That's true. With children with primary attentional difficulties, about a third of that group of children, so within the 5% of the population of children that have ADHD, a third of that group most likely has a learning difficulty of some sort. I mean, underachievement in general is associated with children with primary attention problems or ADHD. And that makes sense, because if you're sitting in the classroom and you're not paying attention, you're getting out of your seat, you're not finishing your work, school achievement will be affected. But then there are a group, a third, of those children that actually have an associated learning problem or an associated other difficulty. So they may have an anxiety disorder, they may have a language-based learning disability or a reading disability. So the two hang together that way.
So Carol, if a child is diagnosed as both having a learning disability and true ADD, mm-hmm. what do you treat first?
You treat both together. I mean, you want to put, and we'll talk a little bit about what you can do for ADHD children, but I mean, one of the main things is a lot of structure, a lot of predictability, a lot of organization to help them then to focus on tasks and complete their work. So that would be going on simultaneously to the actual intervention in the areas that are needed to improve.
Kate, did you want to add to that?
One of the things that we know about children who have attentional difficulties is that they, especially if it's gone on until grade 3 or 4, that although they've been present in the classroom and attended school most days, they haven't been paying attention to all of the lessons.
So not really being present.
Exactly. So they may have missed some of the learning opportunities. And when you ask about which we should treat first, we are always targeting both of them. And where schools are always intervening with reading difficulties, math difficulties, they're looking at that. But if the child still can't pay attention, then we need to make sure that we're dealing with the attention so they can benefit from that instruction.
I just wanted to ask, how do you actually assess for ADD? Because I know with like a learning disability, you would have maybe a psychoeducational assessment, you know, through a psychologist who would, screen for strengths and weaknesses. But how is it the same kind of standardized testing for screening for ADD or ADHD? Who is trained to make a diagnosis?
The diagnosis comes from a licensed health professional who has that training, and that would be a pediatrician, a family doctor, a neurologist, child neurologist, and also a psychologist or psychological associate, somebody who's a member of the College of Psychologists. And they can make that diagnosis by getting a detailed history, so figuring out how long have the symptoms been in existence, because you actually want to see that those symptoms have been there before the age of 7. So especially that it's not a specifically a school-related problem, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that after. But also getting information about when are the symptoms worse and when are they better. And again, how long have they existed and what do they look like? What are those symptoms? And then there may be a number of questionnaires that are filled out by the parents and or by teachers as well to get more information about what that child is like in a variety of situations, because those difficulties have to occur in a variety of situations.
Right.
And those questionnaires can be what we call standardized, because it is really difficult to know how much of these symptoms are then what we can call a problem. A problem in that they are out of the normative expectations compared to what's typical for all children of that age. So those standardized questionnaires are completed, and then the behaviors are compared to other children of that age group. Then you can take the assessment a little bit further to get more information about beyond the attention, well, actually more information about the attentional difficulties and maybe attentional strengths that are present, as well as what is the learning profile like of that child. And that would be the psychoeducational assessment that you were mentioning, Sarah. So you look at those areas.
So, and as you said, you want to see that there's consistency both at home and at school, right? Because you mentioned a little earlier that if the problem exists only at school, then how is that different to it existing both at school and at home?
And what we do often see is that there are differences at home and school.
Okay.
So that often difficulties for children with attention problems are more prominent at school and less so at home. Like we talked about before, the expectations at home are a little bit different. There are also computers, TVs, very fun things to play with. Mm. And children are often better able to pay attention to the fun activities that they're doing at home.
I want to just actually speak to that, because I know, is this a myth or a truth? Then, well, parents will say, but he can't have ADD because he sits and plays with his Lego for hours, or she watches TV for like 5 hours at a time. I have to drag her away from that or her computer. How can he or she have ADD? Is that a myth or a truth?
Well, I think that ADHD is a misrepresenting title at times of what we have, because children with ADHD are always paying attention to something, but they're not able to pay attention necessarily to the right thing or to stop themselves before doing something problematic or to inhibit that movement. So
they can actually pay. So just because they can play with Lego for a long time, or just because they can watch TV or go on the computer for a long time, doesn't mean that they're not... don't
That's
have
right.
true ADD.
And we know that children with ADHD have when they're interested in something, they are able to pay attention for a very long time. And like you talk about, 5 hours of watching TV or playing on the computer is almost over-focused on that task. They're not able to shift and move on to something else. And TV, computer screens tend to be very reinforcing. When you think about what comes on TV, the programs are moving quickly. There's often music, colors, ideas. There's commercials every couple of minutes. And some of the programs for children are made even just for 10 or 15 minute blocks, and it's over and you're on to a new program.
And then within those 10 or 15 blocks, you have images changing every like 20, 30 seconds, right? I know that I've heard it said, and I believe it to be true, that we actually are raising children in a kind of an ADD society, because we give them so much and they're so used to going to Google and quickly getting their information quickly. So everything is quick, quick, quick. And I know that recently I did a presentation to grade 8 students, and some of the feedback was that the presentation wasn't exciting enough, you know? And I thought to myself, well, that must be one of the hardest audiences to teach to, because those children and younger expect to be entertained within very small increments, or things to be changing all the time. Carol, you wanted to add to that?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we know from what research tells us is that reinforcement, actually giving children something that they find rewarding or reinforcing, does help them focus their attention better. And that's true for children with ADHD as well.
So the TV actually
does that for them. So if they're watching and it's exciting and it's changing quickly, or they get their answer quickly, then they have actually been reinforced. They've actually been rewarded for sitting. So by virtue, our society, I think, is doing that. And when you were speaking to those grade 8 students, they also were looking for that kind of instant gratification.
Right.
But we do know in general that shaping behavior can be done quite well just by giving a reinforcement.
And what about things like screens, like DSs and, you know, the small screens that children are on all the time? I mean, in some way, are we teaching children to hyper-focus on things for too long and to not be able to distract their attention away to other things? Kate?
Well, I think one of the things that we're doing is not giving me the opportunity to practice not being interested. So for example, having a screen in a minivan, when you're going on a road trip, it's wonderful for parents because the children are quiet, they're sitting, they're watching the screen, they're not asking, are we there yet? We need to play another game, or I'm out of coloring books, or whatever it may be. And we need to give the children that opportunity to be bored or to play with lower technology toys that requires their brain to be generating the stimulation and the practicing.
The conductor to actually be to be work.
And not to be missing out, right? I mean, if they're focused on the screen, they're not also taking in lots of different things around them, like just even the cows in the field outside.
Exactly. And just thinking about, yeah, all of those running, jumping, developing those gross motor skills, fine motor skills. It's one of the things we also see with a lot of children with attention problems is fine motor skill difficulties with the paper pencil kinds of things. They tend to have larger print. It's a little bit messier. So they do need time off the screens and practicing those activities. And there was Dr. Leonard Sachs mentioned a statistic at a conference I was at a few years ago that any more than 6 hours a week of screen time, and that seems really small, yeah. 6 hours a week, there's a direct negative correlation with academic achievement, meaning the more screen time you watch, the lower the grades go. Wow. And what it's believed is that kids are not practicing all those other skills that they need while they're watching screens. And like Carol said, the screen is so reinforcing that the child doesn't need to generate the cognitive activity to practice all these mm-hmm. skills they need.
I just want to move back to the treatment. We talked about medication, and I know that it's normal for parents to feel concerned about putting their children on medication. One of the things that they worry about is that their children will become like zombie-like, you know, that they'll take any kind of life out of the child, so to speak. And I know that parents do need to find the right dosage, the right person to prescribe the medication. But what else, how else can parents evaluate whether medication is the right thing for their child?
I think a good place to start is by having a good conversation with the medical practitioner, whether that's the family doctor or the pediatrician, and finding out more about the research around medication and ADHD and what it can do for their child. There's many different medications, and there's many different dosages. And one thing that they can do for parents that are having particular reservations or perhaps the medical practitioner would like to try would be something called a double blind. And that is where you can actually try different medications or the same medication with different dosages at different periods of time, as well as a placebo, which would be a sugar pill. And then that the child is then rated, their behavior, their symptoms are rated while they're on that medication or not medication, different dosage, etc. And nobody knows except the pharmacist whether the child is on a medication or not.
So the parent doesn't know what medication they're giving their child. It could be the sugar pill or it could be the real medication. Mm-hmm. The teacher doesn't know.
Mm-hmm. So it's more objective and a more objective.
So in other words, there's no outside influencers. Mm-hmm. The environment is not contributing to the way that the child, like there's no expectations that it's changing the child's behavior. That way that the teacher, for example, can more legitimately say, yes, the child has been more attentive today, listen to instructions, or the child hasn't. Mm-hmm. And the parent, too, can evaluate it. So that's a great way to...
And over a period of more than one day. Right. I mean, it's important to remember that we know a lot about... Research knows a lot about these medications. And they target the area of weakness, so to speak, in the brain. It's not really like taking a Tylenol for a pain in your big toe and your whole body. It's affected.
Right.
It does very specifically target the areas of the brain that it's supposed to. So I think parents talking to their medical practitioner and learning more about the medication will help to demystify and make them feel comfortable, because there's a lot of opinions that float around that aren't necessarily true.
Kate, did you want to add to that?
My first suggestion to parents is not to Google these medications. Like Carol was saying, talk to the doctor. And the other person who's great to talk to about this is a pharmacist.
Right.
If you go into a local pharmacy, the pharmacist will probably give you 5 or 10 minutes of their time, and they know so much about these medications and how they affect the entire body.
That's true. That's great. Those are both great ideas. And what about sometimes I've found that children who don't go on the right medication when they need to will sometimes self-medicate when they're older. So sometimes kids who become adolescents with ADD might resort to taking recreational drugs as a way of perhaps calming themselves down. So do you guys, do you ladies have any ideas about that in terms of how they might sometimes self-medicate?
Well, there have been large-scale studies that have actually looked at that with teenagers and found that adolescents that are taking stimulant medication are less likely actually to engage in recreational drugs. And when you think about it from a common sense point of view, that actually, it does make sense, because if you are impulsive and you're inattentive, then you are going to be more likely to try this that your peer has introduced to you at a party. But if you're actually more focused when you're on stimulant medication, then you are going to be less likely to engage in rather reckless behaviors.
Right. And you're thinking more clearly.
Exactly.
And I just want to come back to the question you asked a few moments ago about being zombie-like,
right.
And that's certainly never the goal of these medications, that if ever you had a child who was zombie-like, you need to talk about that with your doctor, that it's really important to monitor these medications, because the change you should see in your child is just paying better attention and the reduced activity level. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be to the point where they're just sedated.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Good point. So let's just talk about some of the treatment, not the medical treatment options, but some of the do's and don'ts for parents. Some things that would not be a good idea for parents to do with their true ADD, ADHD child, or things that would be helpful. Like you talked about environment and genetics mm-hmm. being key factors, so this is the environmental piece.
And it's similar to when we think about the treatment of diabetes, for example. We have a medical component, but we also need diet and exercise. And neither one of those things on its own will manage diabetes. With a child with ADHD, we need to be looking at the medical piece, but also the environmental lifestyle piece. And one of the things that we need to start with is supporting parents, because we know, as we were talking about earlier, that there's a genetic component to ADHD, and that certainly doesn't mean that every parent of every child with ADHD has these problems themselves, but sometimes disorganization or time management can be an issue, being able to carry out a program can be concerning, so we need to start by working with the parents to support them to develop the skills that they're going to need with their child. And what that essentially is a lot of structure and being the conductor. So the parent often needs to stay much more involved with a child or adolescent with ADHD, getting involved with organization, maybe dumping out the backpack on Saturday mornings and going through it together.
And if the parent doesn't have these skills, him or herself, then that would be something that you might even, as you said, help the parent with first in assessing his or her ability to do that, so that then she can transfer or he can transfer those skills onto the children.
And like you mentioned earlier, you know, an adult with an ADHD coach. So even providing that support to the child or to the parent themselves, of somebody who can coach them through how to carry this out.
So is that something that either one of you would do in terms of coaching the children?
Absolutely, yeah.
So what would be some of the strategies that you would provide to the kids as a coach?
As a coach, I would provide very practical strategies. So looking at what the child needs in their life today, often it's looking at organization, time management. Although we put all these strategies in place, things like putting tabs in the binder, having pockets for notes to come home to parents, it doesn't always occur to that child to use those strategies. So making sure that not only do we have a coach or someone to go through it, but there's somebody there day to day to check in on the binder, to help put the papers in before the organization gets out of.
Right. And I guess these skills would be useful for any parent and child, regardless of ADD or not, right?
Absolutely.
Because
yeah.
When a child's very young, you want to show your child how to put all the blocks into one bin and all the crafts into another bin as a way of organizing. Because I know, even in my house and everybody's house, it's a lot easier even to find things if we have things clumped together. If we have things clumped together in the right spot. Mm-hmm. Anything else that you want to add, Carol?
Well, as Kate said, the main things are the time management, the organization, and consistency. But it is hard to actually implement that in various situations. But the consistency piece between school and home would be very helpful. So whatever structural management kinds of strategies are being used at home, then if there is a coach involved, or the parent per se, should be contacting the teacher and talking about those kinds of things that they found effective at home, and vice versa, what's being effective at school, and seeing if there can be some consistency between the two.
And any other resources or books that you might recommend for parents?
I can just mention one strategy that's really helpful, because it's a strategy that teachers often use when they're teaching academics, as well as parents can use at home. And that is, if you just step back for a second and think about all of the things that need to be put in place, the structure and the management, timetables, et cetera, that can be helpful to children. If we just give those things to children or adolescents, it's hard for them to actually use them day to day. And we know that as adults, you know, we're given things and we don't always follow through. So if you can just use a particular teaching strategy that we use called a graduated release of responsibility. It's a fancy term, but all it is it follows the steps of I do, we do, and you do. So as a parent or as a teacher, you're going to show them, that child or that adolescent, what you want them to do. And then do it together with them. That's the we do part. And a child with a primary attention problem might need more examples or more practice of the we do together. And then when you think that they can do that independently, then you move to the you do, rather than starting with the you do independently and finding that there's an error, it's not working. Oh, this is how you do it, let's do it together. Starting with the I do, then following by let's do it together, let's practice, and then you do.
So I think that it's also important to know that parents need to stay involved for a longer time with children who have attention problems. So they may need to continue through middle school and into high school, being involved with the daily organization, tracking assignments, planning for upcoming tests and exams. And there are a lot of resources, certainly, that parents can access in the community through the school to help them with developing that kind of a system.
Mm-hmm. Many children with attention difficulties also have social problems, making friends, keeping friends, because they tend to interrupt and put their foot in their mouth, so to speak, and move from friendship to friendship. So the Learning Disabilities Association of Canada and the Learning Disabilities Association of Ontario have social skills groups that might be helpful. Schools have social skills groups that might be helpful for those students.
And what about any other resources that you can think of? Any books?
There's one author that I really recommend for parents. His name is Russell Barkley. He has a book called Taking Charge of ADHD, as well as a number of other books. And in Taking Charge of ADHD, he gives parents a 14-step guide to parenting a child with ADHD. It's very clear-cut and provides you a lot of ideas you can use at home. There's also a great website, Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto has a website about kidshealth.ca, and that if you look at the resource centers tab, there is a link for ADHD, and it just provides parents with a lot of information about attentional problems in children. Mm-hmm. Also, CHAD Canada, it's Children and Adolescents, Children and Adults with Attention Disorders, is chaddcanada.org.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here, for all your words of wisdom. I really appreciate everything that you've had to offer. And thank you for listening to this podcast. We hope you found the show informative. For more information about upcoming podcasts and for ways to contact Carol and Kate, visit the podcast section of www.helpmesara.com, and that's spelled S-A-R-A. You can also subscribe to Help Me Sara podcasts on iTunes, subscribe on my Help Me Sara Facebook page, or follow me on Twitter @HelpMeSara. Until next time.